Well, good morning. I think we're ready here for our second lesson in the book of Proverbs. And today I'd like to cover the author, the setting, and the purpose of Proverbs. So Proverbs opens with, in the first verse, the Proverbs of Solomon, the son of David, king of Israel. So at first glance, it might seem it's perfectly clear who wrote and who authored the material in this book. And there are some additional passages throughout the book which help give some support to Solomon's authorship, and a few which might seem to indicate there were some contributing authors. So as you can see in verse 1, it just says it in the clearest possible terms that these are the Proverbs of Solomon, and then defines who Solomon is, the son of David, the king of Israel. And then in the opening of chapter 10, which is a marked section in the book, we move from the discourse proverbs to more of the couplet proverbs, starting in chapter 10. Verse 1 there states that these are the Proverbs of Solomon. So he's beginning a new section in the book, and he restates the authorship and mentions it explicitly here. But then in verse 20, in chapter 22 and verse 17, we have the phrase, incline your ear and hear the words of the wise, which many scholars have taken to indicate that there is a shift here and someone new is writing in this particular section. And then when you get to chapter 25, well, let me back up for just a moment there and mention one other thing about these words to the wise. In chapter 22 and 17, and then 24, 23, these things also belong to the wise is taken by many to indicate that there is a supplemental author here. I'm unconvinced that anyone but Solomon, with two exceptions, wrote all these proverbs. I don't think there's reason, based on what we find in chapter 22 and chapter 24, to think someone other than Solomon said it. In fact, in following this passage in 22:17, just a couple verses down, that the Proverbs are given in the first person singular. You know, I did this, I did that. And the same is true for chapter 24:23. So it doesn't seem quite right to me to think that a group of individual wrote the rest of Proverbs, but still wrote them in the first person singular. So I think the idea that we need to account for supplemental authors is unsupported. But I also don't know why Solomon would explicitly say these are the words of the wise, or these things belong to the wise. What I hope to cover at the end is in the dedication of the book that he specifically mentions in chapter 1, verse 6, the words of the wise as one of the components of the preface to the book of Proverbs. So the phrase itself is not unfamiliar to Solomon for areas that we know he explicitly authored. So I don't think, even as we're moving through chapter 22 and 24, we need to look for evidence of supplemental authors. I think the burden of evidence at face value is on the Solomonic authorship of the book, and we should be content to see his hand written all over the book unless we're deliberately guided some other way. So I'm unconvinced that the words of the wise in 22 and 24 are someone else. As you read different commentators, and I didn't map this, but I suspect that the more modern you get, the more likely it is they believe in multiple authors. Not to say that previously there was a view of only single authorship, but it did seem like more people entertain the idea of multiple authors for this book. Then you get to chapter 25 and things take another turn. So if you're unfamiliar with the layout of the book of Proverbs, so you start with Solomon's his authorship, his byline, and then you move to his dedication and his purpose, and then you move to the discourse sections, which are often, but not always, started with my son do this, my son do that. And that continues through 9 chapters. Those proverbs are longer, and are ornate. And when you get to chapter 10, there's just a complete change where you are in the realm of largely unassociated couplets as you move through the almost to the end of the book. There are some exceptions, but that's largely the case. So you've already changed the way you're moving through Proverbs by the time you get to 10, and perhaps that's the reason why he restates his authorship, is because he's attempting a very different structure for the rest of the book. But when you get to chapter 25, you get this section that says, "These also are the Proverbs of Solomon, which the men of Hezekiah, king of Judah, copied." And this has opened the door for many people to speculate that Solomon was not the author of Proverbs, but instead this was composed at a later time. Now, Hezekiah lived roughly, by the way, does everybody know when Solomon lived? When he reigned? I mean, that's usually the dates that are important. They got a guess as to when roughly Solomon reigned? What time period in Israel we're looking at?
Wait, after David.
After David? Yeah. Does anybody have a numerical idea? Something a little bit more absolutely referenced. Or can tell me when David reigned. Either one would be fine.
I was really minor around 1500 B.C.
About 1500 B.C. Do I hear 1600? 1600. Give me a 1600. 1200. Are we going down or are we going up?
Plus or minus 200 or 300.
Plus or minus 200 or 300 years. Okay.
It's getting closer to 900 or 1000.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's where typically his reign's associated around the 970s, something in that basic ballpark. David reigned for 40 years, and his reign was right about at 1000 B.C. So Solomon didn't reign, I don't believe he reigned quite as long as David did. I may be wrong in that, but from about 970 is the start of his reign. So what about Hezekiah? When did Hezekiah reign? Or what do we know about Hezekiah? It's actually important to know something about him to understand the book of Proverbs.
He was a good king.
He was a good king. That's yes. That's right. He was a very good king, in fact.
He was after Solomon.
He was after Solomon. Yes. He was a descendant of Solomon. Yes, that's right. Yeah. What else?
Several generations later than Solomon. I can't remember how many. Uzziah, Jotham, Ahaz, Hezekiah. Kind of in order. Mm-hmm.
Guy was
quite a ways after Solomon.
Yes. So largely about 200 years. So Hezekiah is one of the good kings. And one of the things that Hezekiah does throughout his reign is this rediscovery of God's word and the importance of God's word for the life of Israel. And here we have an explicit reference of some of the work of Hezekiah and his men. Now, it says here that these also, so I think we pick up on this also saying that these other words are, and these words also are, the Proverbs of Solomon, which his men, Hezekiah's men, had copied. So, the question then is, how much did Hezekiah's men copy, and what do we do with these? What exactly did Hezekiah's men do? So, part of the problem is this, the word we use for copied here, the Hebrew word has a broader meaning than just copied. It also is translated elsewhere that the men moved the Proverbs of Solomon. So we don't have to hold to an idea that Hezekiah's men strictly had copied something. It could be that they moved it. And one of the ideas behind this is that Hezekiah's men, these are the holy men who were advocating for God's word and who wanted to see Israel transformed. They're the ones that seems to have taken the body of literature that Solomon composed and then added from Solomon's body of literature these proverbs, being under the inspiration of the Spirit to do so, and appended them to the existing work. So if you look at it that way, then you see Proverbs 1 all the way to 10 being one distinct section of many topics, and then, or through 9 anyway, and then from 10 all the way up to 24, where the style changes, you also have Solomonic authorship. And then when you get to 25, you see here's the part where Hezekiah's men took over and inserted a body of literature that they had moved from what was well known to be of Solomon's to something that was functioning as the book of Proverbs at that time. So one of the questions then remains, what do we do about the what is sometimes referred to the guest appendices of Proverbs, chapters 30 and 31, which we see here that these are the words of Agur, the son of Jacob, his utterance. This man declared to Ithiel and Ukal. And then in 31, the words of King Lemuel, the utterance which his mother taught him. So we have this chapter 25 to chapter 31, is there another division? Did Hezekiah's men insert the material from 25 through 29 into what Solomon already had? So did Solomon's book go from Proverbs 1 through 24 and include 30 and 31? And then Hezekiah's men inserted 25 through 29. We don't really know for sure whether they inserted that section or whether they inserted 30 and 31. So part of the problem is we don't know anything about Agur. We don't know anything about Jacob. We don't know anything about Ithiel. We don't know anything about Ukal. We don't know anything about Lemuel. Where he was king, what he was king of. There's speculations trying to derive some information from where those names and words have come from, but in the end, we just don't know. We don't know anything about these guys. Were they friends of Solomon? Are they a pseudonym for Solomon? I mean, nobody really knows. But the fact that they are given as personal names and are also given with some genealogy, right? So we have Agur, who's the son of Jacob, and we have Lemuel, who is the son of his mother, which may seem obvious, but for reasons perhaps unknown to us, that was included. Why we only understand Lemuel from his mother's perspective and Agur from his, presumably Jacob's his father. I don't know if that's masculine or feminine. It's unknown to us. So there is some legitimate discrepancy for forming a clear sense of what Hezekiah's men did as it relates to the tail end of Proverbs in these two appendices. But we shouldn't take this to understand that the Solomonic authorship is in dispute from this section. Solomon doesn't claim he authored 30 and 31, but there's no reason to suspect that he didn't approve of what these men wrote and had them personally inserted. So, does that distinction make sense? We're not quite sure what exactly Hezekiah moved or copied or inserted, but we do know that he did something. And thematically, which is perhaps far more important, some of the themes of Proverbs, which we'll look at the very last thing we're going to discuss today. I want to show you some of these undercurrents that run through Proverbs. The themes continue after chapter 24. Chapter 25 through 31 don't break with the underlying theme that Proverbs has established, and particularly Solomon put together. Now there is something that is just quite humorous about, if you're into this sort of humor, about Proverbs 30. So, does everyone know who Jerome was? Or maybe what he did? What can you tell me about Jerome?
He's a forward for the Avs.
He's a forward for the Avs. Did they win last night?
I don't know.
Okay.
Don't tell me.
What else do we know about the other Jerome in history?
Early church father.
Yeah, early church father, that's right. What was that over here?
The Latin Vulgate.
Yeah, yeah. He wrote the what became the definitive edition of the Latin edition of the Bible, which incidentally is the authoritative edition for the Catholic Church. So they do not look to the Greek and Hebrew manuscripts as the authoritative edition of the Bible. And that's actually part of my point. I want to read to you a description one commentator wrote about the words of Agur and how you've got to be careful when you translate things. And I didn't believe him at first. I looked it up, and sure enough, it's the way it is. So a fellow named Thomas Hartwell Horne, who wrote a massive two-volume guide for how to interpret the Bible, lots of information about Bible times and such, he makes this interesting observation about this passage on Proverbs 30, verse 1. He said that Agur, Jacob, Ithiel, and Ucal are proper names admits of no contradiction. Jerome mistook the proper name Agur for an appellative, a title of some sort. And in the Latin Vulgate has translated the expression thus, and he adds, without any meaning, verba congregantis fili momentis, which in the Anglo-Romish version of the Vulgate is with equal unintelligibility rendered the words of gatherer, the son of vomiter. And if you look up the Vulgate translation of Proverbs 30, the English translation of it, and if you don't know what vomitus means, that it means he's the vomiter. So, in this class, we're going to stick with, he's just a guy named Agur, we don't know anything about him, and he is the son of Jacob, something
maybe
like that.
Maybe there's a whole new meaning to the phrase, hey, I'm going to throw up a new idea.
Yeah, see, you learn something new every day, don't you? That's right. So let's talk a little bit about Solomon, because, well, let me ask you a question. Is there anyone think of a reason or a doubt why we shouldn't assume Solomon as the author of Proverbs? Did I make the case convincingly? Do you have something to add to that? Is everyone comfortable with the idea of Solomon? Okay. Well, it's one thing to say, yeah, he's the one that wrote it, but what were his qualifications? Who was Solomon? What do you have to say in a Gustave Doré portrait of Solomon? That was not done in real time. But I thought it would be helpful to have something there to look at. So Solomon is David's son, which he himself... he testifies to in the opening of Proverbs 1. We see this in 1 Chronicles 14, chapter 14, verse 4. He was the... which child of Bathsheba was Solomon? Does anyone know that interesting trivia bit?
Not the first.
It wasn't the first, that's right, yeah. Yeah, he was the second. David dies, Solomon ascends to the throne, and the ascension there is strange set of events, but Solomon is set on the throne. I want to read three different passages. I didn't write these down, but the first comes from 1 Kings 3. Actually, most of it comes from 1 Kings 3, starting in verses 1 through 3. Now, Solomon made a treaty with Pharaoh, king of Egypt, and married Pharaoh's daughter. Then he brought her to the city of David until he had finished building his own house and the house of the Lord and the wall all around Jerusalem. Meanwhile, the people sacrificed at the high places because there was no house built for the name of the Lord until those days. And Solomon loved the Lord, walking in the statutes of his father David, except that he sacrificed and burned incense at the high places. So here we have... not only the description of what Israel was like, but what kind of person Solomon was. He was somebody who walked in the statutes of his father David, and as is unfortunately all too common with many of the kings of Israel, he also sacrificed and burned incense in the high places. So Solomon is completely overwhelmed with the idea of ruling this kingdom and doesn't know what to do. Finds himself in a difficult situation, and they're moving toward the temple dedication and praying, and he he sees, look, this is what's happening around me. I don't have any idea what's going on. And Solomon, it says in verses 6 through 10, it says, you have shown great mercy to your servant David, my father, because he walked before you in truth, in righteousness, and in uprightness of heart with you. You have continued this great kindness for him, and you have given him a son to sit on his throne as it is this day. Now, O Lord my God, you have made your servant king instead of my father David. But I am a little child. I do not know how to go out or to come in. And your servant is in the midst of your people whom you have chosen, a great people, too numerous to be numbered or counted. Therefore, give to your servant an understanding heart to judge your people, that I may discern between good and evil. For who is able to judge this great people of yours? I think anybody, or I think everyone would agree that Solomon is overwhelmed. He sees the task before him. He's also basking in the midst of the goodness of God to put someone on the throne that came after his father David. And his prayer is interesting. Give me an understanding heart to judge your people, that I may discern between good and evil. Now, I didn't look this up in detail, but my suspicion is that word understanding could also be, give me a discerning heart that I can discern. That would be the way he would utter something like that. We'll see that in the preface to the book here, but that idea of understanding and discernment is very important to Solomon. Clearly, I mean, this is what he's praying for. And in verses 10 through 12, he says, the speech pleased the Lord that Solomon had asked this thing. Then God said to him, because you have asked this thing and have not asked long life for yourself, nor have you asked riches for yourself, nor have you asked for the life of your enemies, but have asked for yourself understanding to discern justice. Behold, I have done according to your words. See, I have given you a wise and understanding heart, so that there has not been anyone like you before you, nor shall there be anyone, nor shall any like you arise after you. So what God didn't do is fill his head with a lot of facts. That's not the idea here in Hebrews. What did he give him? He gave him an understanding heart to discern justice. This is what you've asked for, and this is what I've given you. So it's not as if Solomon woke up with the Encyclopedia Britannica or whatever the Jewish equivalent was, and he was instantly the smartest person in the world. I don't think that's the case. I think Solomon had a lot to learn. But I think he had a new capacity to learn, unlike anybody else's capacity to learn. He was given a heart that could understand what was happening. And then we find in verses 16 through 28 of 1 Kings 3, the famous incident that after this great episode where they have the dedication of the temple and all these sacrifices and the glory of God is going forth, Solomon sits on the throne. He sits on his throne of justice. And what's the first case that's brought before him? Two women fighting over a baby. That's right. And so, you know, we have what has been handed down to us is, you know, the wisdom of Solomon, or the idea that Solomon's decree was, of course, to cut the baby, to cleave the baby, and then give half to each woman. And then the actual mother said, no, don't do that, spare the baby. And people were amazed at this wisdom. And it says here that in verse 28, and all Israel heard of the judgment which the king had rendered, and they feared the king, for they saw the wisdom of God was in him to administer justice. The people, when they heard what Solomon had done, they feared the king, and they also feared God. They feared the king because they saw that justice could be executed in the land, because now we have somebody who is wise of heart. So 1 Kings 4 gives us another summary of Solomon. And it tells us that God gave Solomon wisdom and exceedingly great understanding and largeness of heart like the sand of the seashore. Thus Solomon's wisdom excelled the wisdom of all the men of the east and all the wisdom of Egypt. For he was wiser than all men, than Ethan, the Ezrahite, and Heman of Kalkol, of Darda, the sons of Mahol, and his fame was in all the surrounding nations. He spoke 3,000 proverbs, and his songs were 1,005, And he also spoke of trees from which the cedar trees of Lebanon, even to the hyssop that springs out of the wall. He spoke also of animals, of birds, of creeping things, and of fish. And men of all nations, from all the kings of the earth who had heard of his wisdom, came to hear the wisdom of Solomon. This is an interesting description of Solomon's knowledge. The idea here, it said that he spoke 3,000 proverbs. Now, we've already discussed a bit about this idea of what a proverb is. It's this condensed saying, right? It's compacted. We'll look at the definition here in just a minute, but it's something that takes craft. It's something that takes work to formulate. It's not just a funny saying, or it's not just a useful saying, but it's something that requires some real effort. But it was not, his wisdom and observational skills were not limited to just authoring proverbs, but he was also a songwriter. 1,000 songs. Somebody said? Yeah, 1,005 songs. Now, in terms of the sheer volume of creativity, I don't know any contemporary today, anybody today that's authored 1,000 songs of any kind of meaning. I think if you had a professional career and wrote 100 songs that were well thought out, I think people would think you were in the genius category. You know, a couple hundred, I don't know what the threshold would be. But the idea that somebody could actually write 1,000 songs of original content, compose 3,000 couplet verses, proverbs, and covering every area, it seems, I don't know what's left out of here, to where people want to come see you. They want to come visit. You know, we're specifically told that the Queen of Sheba came to hear what's, I mean, she had heard these rumors and didn't believe it. There's no way somebody's this smart until she went there. And what were her observations? Well, it's not just that you're smart, but it's the way the palace is decorated, the way the diplomats, the way your people are arrayed, the way they stand, the way the food set on your table, I believe, is one of the comments you make. This is what I have heard didn't do justice to who you really are. But there's a distinction here I want to emphasize, that Solomon was not simply an early Aristotle. Now, one of the things that happened in medieval history, scholastic history, is the rediscovery of Aristotle and his contributions to science and methodology and the translation of his works and ability to understand what he did. I mean, Aristotle was a remarkable human being. And he's known, you know, he was in Plato's school for many years, and then he wrote volumes of material on everything. I mean, he was a smart guy. But Aristotle was stuck. Aristotle did not understand the fear of God. His wisdom, his insight, his methodology truly was a gift from God, but it didn't lead toward a gift or toward the fear of God. Aristotle was bright and worth reading, but he's not Solomon. And Solomon's not Aristotle. The two are not the same. I don't think here we have a lot of question in our mind of who wrote the book of Ecclesiastes. Pastor went through it. Solomon's the author. But here in the closing of chapter 12, moreover, because the preacher was wise, he still taught the people knowledge. Yes, he pondered and sought out and set in order many proverbs. The preacher sought to find acceptable words, and what was written was upright, words of truth. The words of the wise are like goads, and the words of scholars are like well-driven nails given by one shepherd. So you can see here at the close of Ecclesiastes this idea that Solomon spent his life working very hard to teach people. He was given a mind to inquire and to understand that was unlike anyone else. And specifically, we're taught that he pondered and he sought out to set in order many proverbs. So the book we're about to study is a book that has a lifetime of thought contained within it. The idea of pondering, it's not just that it came to him in a stroke of brilliance and, oh, well, there's another one. Oh, wait a minute, there's another one. I better write this down as well. It's not that. It's that Solomon spent a great deal of time thinking about things. And God gave him the ability to understand what he was thinking about. And that's a big plus, isn't it? It's one thing to spend a lot of time thinking about topics. It's something else altogether to be able to understand what it all means when you're done thinking about it. And that's the beauty of what Solomon did. And in Ecclesiastes, we find that it wasn't just for the sake of knowledge. It wasn't simply to add to the body of knowledge out there. And there's an important point to be made here about that. The point of what Solomon did was to teach God's people the fear of the Lord, to understand the world around them in a certain light, to understand it as somebody who was studying what God had done in the world. So I think it's safe to say that Solomon is uniquely qualified as the author of the composer of these Proverbs. Now, before we get into verses 2 to 6, I want to make a point about the volume of literature that Solomon authored. So it's said that he spoke. It didn't say that he wrote. It says that he spoke 3,000 Proverbs. He also has 1,000 songs, and on a lot of material that we don't have today. No one knows what happened to that material. But in the providence of God, under the inspiration of the Spirit, we have the collection of Proverbs that God wanted to preserve for us. This is an important idea that's often forgotten as we think about the preservation of the Scriptures to come down to us, that the Holy Spirit is preserving the body of information that He wants His people to permanently have. You know, so think about it this way for a minute. Writing, Adam and Eve didn't write anything, did they? Writing wasn't invented back then. So Adam and Eve didn't write stuff. How do we know what God communicated to Adam and Eve? What was the method?
The recording in Genesis by Moses.
By Moses, that's right. How did Moses get it? It's passed down from one person to the next. One of the reasons I think they had such long lives back then was to make sure that the knowledge was disseminated without error. To be disseminated generation after generation after generation. And in a sense, if you look the distance between Moses and Adam in terms of the number of individuals who would have been alive, it's not that long of a chain of custody of this verbal revelation. It's not. And Moses was not the only one who would have known the information that he was writing. Moses didn't wander off into a wilderness somewhere. Well, I mean, he did, but not. He didn't just wander around thinking, well, I need God to tell me what to write to compose the Pentateuch. The histories that he composed would have been well known to all of Israel, but it was preserved in this fashion, in written form, for us today. These things are written for us, is what 1 Peter tells us. So but not every single thing that God said to anyone has been recorded for us. God spoke to Adam and Eve, the things he told them that he didn't tell us. I'm sure he spoke to Cain and Abel. We have no idea what those words are. Solomon had 3,000 Proverbs. We don't know all of them. We have a few hundred at best. Depends on how you want to divide them. So what we do have is preserved for us by the work of the Holy Spirit, so that you can receive the goads that are referred to in Ecclesiastes here, so you can find out what God wants us to learn through the appointed king that he has set on the throne. This is a really, really big deal to make sure we understand. This is not the Jewish equivalent of the body of Greek literature. It doesn't have that in mind. It's not here to simply discover for the sake of discovering. The book of Proverbs is designed to make you holy so that you walk in the fear of God. Any questions about that? All right, we're not going to finish this next section, but we'll start it today, and then we'll pick it up next week, but I thought we'd take time to look at our Yiddish proverb of the week. And I like this one. No one knows whose shoe pinches except the person who walks in it. No one knows whose shoe pinches except the person who walks in it? So if you want to forget your troubles, put on your own tight shoes. I think I'm going to be Yiddish when I grow up. I found a couple other odd proverbs that struck me as somewhat on the humorous side. He who is bitten by a snake fears even a rope. Yeah. A scalded cat fears even cold water. Now, I really thought about putting a picture up of that, but whoever is burned on hot squash blows on cold yogurt. Now, I don't know what you're going to get out of this class, but you're going to get something out of this class. All right, let's take a look at the setting and the purpose here of Proverbs. The next section we find after the byline on verse 1 is to know wisdom and instruction, to perceive the words of understanding, to receive the instruction of wisdom, justice, judgment, and equity, to give prudence to the simple, to the young man knowledge and discretion. A wise man will hear and increase learning, and a man of understanding will attain wise counsel. To understand a proverb and an enigma, the words of the wise and their riddles. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of knowledge, but fools despise wisdom and instruction. So, who is looking at these verses, specifically 2 through 6, who is this book written for? Who is the primary audience, the intended recipients of this, of these proverbs, looking at this? What was that?
Simple and young.
The simple and the young, that's right. Give prudence to the simple, to the young man. Anybody else?
Wise man.
The wise man, yep. What else? One more in there. We've got three of them so far. The simple, the young, the wise man.
The man of understanding.
And the man of understanding. So, Proverbs was written, now, I don't know if this, I don't know if I need to issue a trigger alert, is that what they call them today? But, you know, Solomon isn't interested in addressing the fact that girls need to learn this, right? It just wouldn't occur to him to say, to give to the young man slash woman, right? But that doesn't mean women aren't able to learn from the book of Proverbs. I hope that's abundantly clear. When Solomon's addressing, what are you laughing at over there? When Solomon's addressing young men, he also means young women. And when he says, my son, sometimes he only means my son, but there are times the application crosses genders. And the wise man as well as the wise woman. So get the understanding of that out of the way. In other words, everybody is covered here. If you're simple-minded, which everyone is, now, when you say someone's simple-minded, we'll look at that in a minute, but we're talking about not whether or not you could build your own flux capacitor, right? I mean, that would be ideal if we could build our own flux capacitor. I don't know how to build it. I'm simple-minded in flux capacitor technology, all right? But the goal here is the fear of the Lord. So if you are simple, or if you're a young man or a young woman, or if you've already attained some measure of wisdom or understanding, the book of Proverbs is written for you. So everyone has an opportunity to learn. So let's look at this idea of knowing wisdom. This idea to know, it's used in different ways throughout the scriptures, but the idea to know is to become acquainted with wisdom. Solomon wants you to, what he's saying here is, I want to take you and I want to introduce you to my friend, wisdom. And I want you to have a meaningful relationship with it. So, Proverbs is written for you to have a new friend. That friend will be called wisdom, and wisdom is personified in various ways through Proverbs, but you should think of wisdom as a friend. And when we look at words like the wise and wisdom, they really have kind of a broad set of meanings, but not to the Hebrews. The Hebrews, would not have thought of wisdom as simply a broad collection of facts or knowledge about the world. You know, the fact that the speed of light is, I don't know, fast, would not have been something the Hebrews would have attributed as a virtue. I'm assuming it's fast. I don't actually know how fast it is, but that's all right. I don't even know when my kids' birthdays are, so there are a lot of things that I don't really pay attention to, but there are some things I do know. But for the Hebrews, this idea of a bare collection of knowledge would not have been important. What would have been important to them is the idea that you had a craft, that you had honed the knowledge and applied it to your life. The knowledge that you were seeking was not something just abstract, but was something that was very much applied. In fact, you would have your life governed by this knowledge that you have become acquainted with. And that knowledge is the fear of the Lord. So the idea of someone, if you met somebody who was very good at memorizing, and they could tell you many things about the scriptures, they could quote many scriptures, but their life was wholly given over to fulfilling lust, the Hebrew would say, he's not wise. It's not that he's ignorant. I mean, he is ignorant. He's ignorant of the fear of God. But he's not a wise individual. And we translate this word wisdom in many different ways. So skill, as in war, somebody who is proficient in the art of war is considered wise, somebody who understands wisdom. You can have a level of wisdom in administration, being able to govern things appropriately. Shrewdness is another way of thinking of wisdom. Prudence, such as in religious affairs, are all ideas embodied with this idea of wisdom. So the wise man is the man who understands the ways and the skills and the practice of something. He knows what to do with the information. It's not just that he has it, but he knows what to do with it. He knows how to apply it. It's never isolated in its own container just for the sake of filling that container. Solomon says that Proverbs teaches us how to understand the ways and the skills and the practice of the fear of Yahweh. I mean, that's what that says, the fear of the Lord. I didn't write it in small caps, but it's Yahweh. It's the covenant God, the great self-existent God, the I Am. Solomon says, this is what these proverbs are designed to do. I want to acquaint you with this wisdom, and I want you to possess it so that it transforms you, so that you know how to practice the fear of Yahweh. In verse 2, the idea of perceiving the words of instruction. Perceive the words of understanding. One of the things you'll find is it's difficult, I think, to translate Proverbs. I hope to show you some of this. I don't think we'll get to it this week, but it's really, really hard because there are, in verse 7, I think there are 6 or 8 words in verse 7. That's it. And how do you convey the richness of what somebody's trying to say when they said it in a half dozen words or so? Most proverbs are between 8 and 10, 8 and 12 words, something along these lines. But the idea of words of understanding or words of instruction is sometimes how it's translated, seems a bit weak. The word under there is mashar. And the idea of this, of these words of instruction, is discipline, of chastening or correction. I don't get the sense when I think of instruction as correction which results in education, right? I think that's what Solomon has in mind here, is that instruction or correction that comes through, which results in education. So anybody who's a parent knows that sometimes your kids need mental information, right? But then they need that information backed up with the rod. You've explained it to them, and they understand the rightness and the wrongness of a particular conduct, but they're not doing it. So the description of this person in Proverbs is he's not wise. This person is the simple, or perhaps the fool. He doesn't know how to do the right thing yet, but it's not from a lack of instruction. It's not from a lack of words, a lack of knowledge. What he needs is correction. So sometimes that correction takes place physically, right? I mean, parents correct people. The civil magistrate physically corrects people, right? He bears not the sword in vain. So the idea that some people need to be reasoned with on a level beyond words is part of everyday living. And the idea Solomon has here is that you need to become acquainted with my friend wisdom so that your whole life will be corrected. So that it what? So that you're walking in the fear of God, the fear of Yahweh. So when that seems like an awful lot to say about just a couple of words here, but that's where Solomon pondered and he sought to set in order the Proverbs to communicate what was important, to communicate what it is that he wants you to be. And what he wants you to be is holy, to walk in the fear of God. Now, we don't have time to go through all of these so if you're keeping track, we covered verse 1 and we covered to know wisdom and instruction in verse 2. We're not going to go at this pace. We're not going to continue. But I think it's important that we cover in some detail these first 7 verses, and then we'll take the discourse Proverbs one section at a time, and then we'll group the rest together thematically. But that's the direction. We're not going to spend this much time on every nuanced word. We can't do that. Any questions or observations?
Thank you. Mm-hmm. One question. Is it fair to say that with his assertion of the positive, that is, to get your lives corrected, that he's also implying the negative, that is, I want you to avoid God's wrath?
Yes, yes. Yeah, the fear of God certainly has in mind his justice. And you don't want to participate on the wrong side of the justice of God.
Okay, so it's also flee from the Pilgrim's Progress message at the beginning, which was flee from the wrath of God to come.
That's right.
Get on this road.
That's right.
Okay.
I think we understand all of God's commandments as having two components. When our children were young, and if they told a lie or something, that I often sought to frame the discipline as a failure to love the truth. I thought if I pursued the idea of telling them it's wrong to lie, that what I might actually be doing is incentivizing better lying techniques that I couldn't catch. And so I decided that the correction sounded better, and I thought provided a better incentive to say that you failed to love the truth. That's where your sin was, and as a way of changing the frame. So yes, I think the positive injunction and the prohibitions are important. Yes. Any other questions or observations? Solomon would have killed it on Twitter. That's been observed, and he would have hands down. I don't know how many followers he'd have though.
this all says to me. This all communicates connecting the dots. There,
mm-hmm. Yes.
I encounter more and more and more and more situations in life and in the workplace where there are a lot of, you take a particular individual who has some kind of knowledge, has a resume, or has supposedly accumulated some facts, like a Wikipedia. But this person cannot relate those. It's very academic. This person cannot relate these to solving real problems, to action, mm-hmm. to being like MacGyver or something, who not only understands how to build an airplane out of a comb, but can actually build the airplane out of a comb and fly it out to safety. Mm-hmm. So I usually refer to this, or have found it to be somebody who can really not just have dots, but can really connect the dots mm-hmm. and understand how this is going to be in the real world. Proverbs to me seems to be all about people who can connect the dots.
That's a very Hebrew way of thinking about it.
Yeah.
Yep, you nailed it. And in fact, that comes up in these later verses here in the preface. You're exactly right. Connecting the dots is a big deal. Very big. Any other comments? Oh, yes.
This reminds me, those of us homeschool, not everyone homeschools, but back in the day when I was doing it, there was a Dorothy Sayre philosophy that there are three levels of learning that go on. First of all, these three levels have to do with the maturity of the child age-wise. When they get to be a certain age, typically they're able to progress to the next level. And the third level, for some people, never really comes. And I don't know, you know, this is what you're talking about, where you say they can take the knowledge they receive and connect the dots. And I think some people just, I mean, they're B students, maybe A minus students, but they just can't go the next level to creating or to imagining or to inventing new things from what they already know. And I think some of it has to do with maturity physiologically, how the brain cells are connected. But I think some of it also has to do with what God equips us with when we're born. Sometimes we have the ability to connect these synapses, and sometimes we're not. So
that's exactly right. Yep. And that's why Proverbs is written for everyone.
Yeah.
Yeah. Everybody can walk away learning something from Proverbs. Yeah. Any other questions or comments? All right. Let's pray.